There's been a lot written on the relationship between Freud and mysticism and psychoanalysis and mysticism. What I'd like to do with you here today is to focus on one relationship in particular between Freud and a certain mystic, with whom he had a lively friendship and correspondence, a relationship which eventually bubbled over into public view in the form of a chapter in Freud's later work. This is the story of Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, and his friend, the mystic. I hope you enjoy. This episode is being produced in collaboration with a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Justin Sledge, from the YouTube channel Esoterica, which no doubt many of you already know and love. If you don't yet know it, please head over to his channel right away to wish him a mazel tov for recently reaching 200,000 subscribers, and join his incredible community exploring the arcane side of history, philosophy, and religion. Justin is going to be making a sister video to this one, exploring Freud's most controversial concept, the death drive, and its relationship to mysticism, especially in the later thought of Georges Bataille. Make sure to check out his video and say hi from us here. Now, back to the episode. These days, if you ask most people who Sigmund Freud was, there's a good chance they'll have heard of him. But few people will recognize the name of his friend, the mystic, Romain Rolland. However, back in the early 1900s, at the height of their careers, Rolland was as famous, if not more famous, than Freud. Romain Rolland was a French author, novelist, social critic, humanitarian, peace activist, Nobel laureate, and diehard mystic, publishing on the subject of Eastern mysticism and putting his mysticism into practice with his anti-war efforts. Rolland was something of a celebrity, that is, at least until his pacifism and peace activism was seen as unpatriotic and earned him the reputation of a traitor. However, during the height of his fame, Rolland had many admiring fans. One of them was an Austrian atheistic Jewish neurologist by the name of Sigmund Freud. Despite Freud being a secular, scientifically minded Jew, and Rolland being a spiritually minded Catholic man of literature, and 10 years Freud's junior, between the years 1923 and 1936, the two of them carried out quite a warm 13-year-long correspondence. Freud was actually the first to reach out, making contact through a mutual friend, writing, "Since you are a friend of Romain Rolland, may I ask you to pass on to him a word of respectful veneration from an unknown admirer?" Later in Freud's first letter to Rolland himself, Freud writes, "That I have been allowed to exchange a greeting with you will remain a happy memory to the end of my days." This is what we call fanboying pretty hard. A year later, in 1924, Freud, while reading the news, found out that Rolland would be visiting Vienna, where Freud was living, for a fancy classical music festival, and reached out to him again through a mutual friend with the hope to meet Rolland in person. Writing, "When I found out that Romain Rolland was in Vienna, I immediately felt the desire to make the personal acquaintance of the man I have revered from afar, but I did not know how to approach him. I was all the more pleased to hear from you that he wants to visit me as well." He really is kind of cute. Rolland did pay Freud a visit on that occasion, the only time that they ever met in person, actually. Freud, following this visit, described Rolland as an unforgettable man whom he cherished and carried this solitary visit with him in his memory, writes Freud, writing to Rolland later that year, "When I am alone in my study, I often think of the hour you gave me here, and I imagine the red chair which we set out for you." Get a room, you guys. This admiration wasn't just one-sided. Rolland, in turn, described Freud as the great confessor of souls, the Christopher Columbus of a new continent of the spirit, who even in his old age displayed admirable lucidity. Rolland boasted of having discovered Freud, via his work The Interpretation of Dreams, in a little quaint bookstore in Zurich, Switzerland, long before Freud had become cool in France. Writing to him, "I was among the first Frenchmen to know you and read your work." But moving beyond the cuteness of this mutual man crush, which is really cute indeed, we gotta get to the beef between these two great men, which naturally fell over the questions of religion and mysticism. Freud, in one of the letters we mentioned earlier, praises Roland for having his name associated with the most precious of beautiful illusions, that of love extended to all mankind, making him the recipient of unrestrained admiration from the masses in Freud's depiction. And in an attempt perhaps to explain why his own popularity hadn't reached those of his friend the mystic, which somewhat troubled and baffled Freud, Freud continues the letter writing, "But a great part of my life has been spent trying to destroy illusions of my own and those of mankind." And again elsewhere, Freud writes, "Unlike you, I cannot count on the love of the people. I have not pleased, comforted, and edified them." One of the most notorious illusions which comforted mankind in Freud's view was religion. And in 1927, he set out in The Future of an Illusion to dismantle the illusion of religion with the tools of psychoanalysis, with his very scientific attempt to demonstrate that religion was nothing other than the universal obsessional neuroses of mankind, an attempt to patch over our collective daddy issues with the help of one supreme daddy, God. Freud, very proud of his work, sent a copy to Roland, hoping to get his reaction. And in December of 1927, Freud got his reaction. Roland responded to Freud with a letter praising the lucid and spirited little book, appreciating the way it critiqued a juvenile form of religious belief, prevalent amongst the believing masses. But Roland felt that Freud had taken arms against a straw man of religion, criticizing its weakest representation while leaving what Roland took to be the best of religion untouched. This best of religion, its original foundation and finest expression, in Roland's opinion, of course, was mysticism. Roland returns to Freud with a challenge, writing, "Your analysis of religions is a just one, but I would have liked to see you do an analysis of spontaneous religious sentiment, or more exactly, of religious feeling, which is wholly different from religions in the strict sense of the word. What I mean is," continues Roland, "a feeling totally independent of all dogma, all credo, all church organization, all sacred books, all hope for personal salvation, etc. The simple and direct reality of the feeling of the eternal, which may very well not be actually eternal, but simply without perceptible limits, oceanic, as it were." Roland's language here mirrors that of the mystics quoted in William James's highly influential 1902, The Varieties in Religious Experience. Over there, James records the utterings of the mystics, "I was immersed in the infinite ocean of God, tranquil and deep as the respirations of the ocean, serene and limitless as the blue firmament, impelled to kneel down before the illimitable ocean, symbol of the infinite." Roland says that it is precisely this oceanic feeling, of feeling at one with no limits, borders, or boundaries, which is the true subterranean source of religious energy. Roland admits that this feeling is, by definition, subjective, but he writes that it has been experienced by countless people in the past and present in both the religious souls of the West and in the great minds of Asia. And it's not just a fleeting, inconsequential feeling indulged by escapist hedonists, but one which provides mystics with an aptitude for thought and action which proves strongly regenerative for their country and the world, writes Roland. This feeling was one that Roland knew well. He admits to having had the first-hand occasion to observe its rich and beneficent power as a vital source of renewal which never failed him. And lastly, Roland asserts that this feeling is the true underground source of all religious energy, which is only later gathered, channeled, and dried up by the churches. Roland's formulation of his vision of mysticism with which he challenges Freud is typical of the way mysticism had been conceptualized and utilized as a defense not for religion per se, but for religiosity as a whole, all the way from Schleiermacher to James. By circumventing popular religious beliefs, which had been attacked vociferously as naive and outdated in modernity, what these religious thinkers sought to do was to go directly to what they saw as the true source of religion, the feeling of an encounter with the infinite, prior to the accoutrements of dogma and creed, church and ritual, back to that supposedly pure, unassailable, unspoken, original, limitless experience of the mystic. A subjective reality which could neither be proven nor disproven, but could not either be simply dismissed as an illusion, because it was claimed to have been experienced by millions all over the world, past and present, east and west, not just as a fleeting experience, but as a great source of moral vigor and edification, a source of serenity, safety, and meaningfulness. Roland, like James, is trying very hard to distinguish between the first-hand original experiential religiosity of the mystic or the prophet who believes themselves to have encountered the reality of the sacred face-to-face, contrasted with the second-hand organized institutional forms of religion, a mere derivative imitation of the former for Roland and James, ashes and embers where a burning, blazing, unconsumed fire once stood. Just as Freud's former student Carl Jung would put it, defining religious creed as codified and dogmatized forms of original religious experience, and framing the main function of organized religion, maybe a bit tongue-in-cheek, as a means to protect people against a direct experience of God. If Freud is brave enough for the challenge, Roland retorts, he must not only take on the dry, desiccated, emaciated residue of religion as found in the churches, synagogues and mosques, dogmas, creeds and beliefs, but he must go back and face its vibrant, pulsating, organic source and fund, the oceanic, mystical experience, the direct, unmediated encounter with the infinite, the absolute and the eternal. It is there, at its best, where religion must be challenged. The stakes have been raised and cards laid out on the table. Freud, not one to back down from a good challenge, took up the task of applying his psychoanalytic tools to understand and diagnose religion at its finest. Freud set out to psychoanalyze mysticism. But it turns out that this task wasn't as easy as it first seemed, and Freud spent a good deal of time deeply bothered by this question. It would be over 19 months until Freud would respond to Roland, telling him, "Your remark about a feeling you describe as oceanic has left me no peace," ironic, "and that it has caused me no small difficulty." Freud's final response to Roland on the issue takes the shape not of a private letter between friends, but as the first chapter of his next book to the public, which would quickly become one of his bestsellers, dropping some 12,000 copies off the shelves in the first year of its publication in 1930. The book, Das Überhagen in der Kultur, translated into English as Civilization and Its Discontents. Its opening chapter, a response to an unnamed friend. The stakes have indeed been raised. Civilization and Its Discontents is a short book, some 127 pages, a mere 30,000 words in translation, whose primary theme, according to its editor, is the irremediable antagonism between the demands of instinct and the restrictions of civilization. A theme which Freud explored throughout his life and work, the conflict between what our primal selves really want and what society as a whole deems appropriate for us to want and act upon. Internalized in Freudian terms as the conflict between the id, our deepest desires, and the superego, the voice of conscience coming from civilization, telling us what we can and can't do. In Civilization's short pages, Freud takes us on a grand tour through love, narcissism and happiness, religion, science and technology, beauty, justice and work. He speaks about the origins of civilization, Christianity and the devil, communism, guilt, remorse and ethics. And in addition to all these, Freud discusses some of his key terms of psychoanalysis, such as sublimation, ego and superego, identification, group psychology, and finally, the death drive. However, it is the contents of the first chapter to which we shall turn our attention, to Freud's attempt to analyze the mystical experience, or the oceanic feeling, as he puts it there. Freud begins the opening chapter with some astonished praise of a friend whom he calls one of the exceptional few who receive unrestrained admiration from the public, despite this individual's own aims and aspirations being entirely at odds with those of the masses. This friend, who initially goes unnamed, we now know is none other than the writer, poet, peace activist, Nobel Laureate and mystic, the purveyor of the most beautiful of illusions, Romain Rolland. Freud, the self-appointed iconoclast, gets to work in the chapter attempting to shatter the illusion of mysticism. He begins by reiterating the question posed to him by Rolland about this peculiar feeling, which Rolland himself experiences and finds confirmed by millions of people, a feeling of a sensation of eternity, of something limitless, unbounded, as it were, oceanic. A purely subjective fact, just to recap, which brings with it no assurance of personal immortality, but, in Rolland's opinion, is the true source of the religious energy, which is seized upon by various religious systems. One may, Rolland thinks, rightly call oneself religious on the grounds of this oceanic feeling alone, even if one rejects every belief and illusion. Freud responds with a great deal of respect, saying firstly that he has no right to deny the existence of this experience for others, but perhaps somewhat lamentedly, yet frankly, admits to being unable to discover this oceanic feeling in himself. As he had written in an earlier letter to Rolland, "How remote from me are the worlds in which you move. To me, mysticism is just as closed a book as music." Freud tells his friend, the mystic and musician, by the way, that while he doesn't deny that others indeed experience these wonderful oceanic moments of bliss and limitlessness, he's just frankly tone-deaf to the whole mystical orchestra. And as a result, writes in the chapter, "It is very difficult for me to work with these almost intangible qualities," and that as a scientist, writes Freud, "it is not easy to deal with feelings." Sounds like something we may have heard a guy say before. Seeing that the direct experience and feeling isn't subject to his first-hand analysis, Freud proposes another avenue of attack on the mystical. "Nothing remains," writes Freud, "but to fall back on the ideational content, which is most readily associated with the feeling. Namely, that while we can't examine the feeling itself, we can examine the ideas produced by or associated with it." This shift of attention from the experiential to the ideational is a very clever move by Freud, one which Rolland attempted to preemptively prevent with his precise questioning, intentionally making no metaphysical, theological, or soteriological claim, no ideational content was present in his presentation of mysticism. He chose instead just to stick to the raw, subjective psychological facts. But Freud says nay, nay, and prods further than Rolland's gambit was willing to admit, knowing full well what cards he's holding but not showing, a hand which Freud can sink his analytical teeth into. Freud pushes the agenda along, intuiting, as Christine Downing puts it, the almost irresistible move from experience to cognitive elaboration. "If I have understood my friend rightly," continues Freud, he means to say that this oceanic feeling is a feeling of an indissoluble bond, of being one with the external world as a whole. The only question now is whether it is being correctly interpreted, and whether it ought to be regarded as the fons et origo, the source and origin of the whole need for religion. Freud himself provides the interpretation which Rolland conceals, and sets out with two questions. One, does this interpretation, this claim of being at one with the world, follow necessarily from the experience of limitlessness? And two, is this feeling of oneness the true source and origin of religion? Which would be contrary to the claim made elsewhere and previously by Freud that the true source of religion lies in the infantile need for a father figure. Freud takes the first question head-on and rejects the validity of a metaphysical cause or interpretation of this experience, writing, "The idea of an individual receiving an intimation of their connection with the world around them through an immediate feeling, which is from the outset directed to that purpose, seems so strange and fits so badly with the fabric of our psychology that one is justified in attempting to discover a psychoanalytic explanation of such a feeling." Freud, incredulous that the universe and the human psyche might come into some sort of direct communication, proposes instead his own psychoanalytic explanation of this experience, arguing that normally there is nothing of which we are more certain than the feeling of ourselves, of our own ego, which appears to us as something autonomous and unitary, marked off distinctly from everything else, with clear and sharp lines of demarcation. "There is only one non-pathological state," writes Freud, "in which the external boundaries of the ego are blurred, namely, the state of love, in which the boundaries between lover and beloved seem to melt away. But that which can be temporarily done away with, in normal psychological processes, such as in love," writes Freud, "can also be done away with by pathological processes. Pathology," Freud writes, "has made us acquainted with a great number of states in which the boundary lines between the ego and the external world become uncertain, or in which they are actually drawn incorrectly. Thus, even the feeling of our own ego is subject to disturbances, and the boundaries of the ego are not constant." Freud continues to reason that the ego of the adult cannot have been the same from when they were a child, but must have gone through a process of development, which leads him to the point that he's been building up to this entire time. An infant at the mother's breast does not yet distinguish their ego from the external world as the source of the sensation flowing in upon them. They only gradually learn to do so. A newborn child, writes Freud, does not know that there exists a delimited self and a separate world around them. They exist in a state of limitless narcissism, as he calls it. It is only with time that the child observing and differentiating between internal and external stimuli comes to realize that there exists a world beyond themselves. As Freud writes, "One comes to learn, through a deliberate direction of one's sensory activities, to differentiate between what is internal, what belongs to the ego, and what is external, what emanates from the outside world. In this way, then, the ego detaches itself from the external world." Or, to put it more correctly, writes Freud, "originally the ego, in its self-conception, includes everything. Only later does it separate off an external world from itself. Our present ego feeling is, therefore," continues Freud, "only a shrunken residue of a much more inclusive, indeed all-embracing feeling, which corresponded to a more intimate bond between the ego and the world around it." And here Freud comes full circle to address Rollin's question. If we may assume that there are many people in whose mental life this primary ego feeling has persisted to a greater or lesser degree, the sense that the ego encompasses all of existence, it would exist in them side by side with the narrower and more sharply demarcated ego feeling of maturity, like a kind of counterpart to it. In that case, the ideational contents appropriate to it would be precisely those of limitlessness and of a bond with the universe. Thus, we are perfectly willing to acknowledge that the oceanic feeling exists in many people, and we are inclined to trace it back to that early phase of ego feeling. Freud returns to acknowledge the reality of the oceanic feeling, but instead of seeing it as an authentic reflection of a deeper state of reality, be it psychological or metaphysical, one to be endorsed for its veridicality and for its redemptive, empowering, life-affirming qualities, Freud instead dismisses it as a state of ego expansion, a regression to or hangover from infancy, in which the babe at its mother's boob does not know where it ends and the external world begins. Hardly an enlightened state, Freud would have us believe. Others differ. Having addressed his first question of the true source of the oceanic feeling, Freud now moves on to the second question, whether this oceanic feeling is the true source of religion. Freud responds that the claim that the oceanic feeling is the source of religious need, the emotional place from which religion is born psychologically, to be an uncompelling claim, and instead returns to reaffirm his prior diagnosis that the psychological need for religion is the infant's helplessness and the longing for the father aroused by it. The deep need for a strong father figure, whether earthly or heavenly, to bring us fragile humans a sense of safety in the face of the capricious fate of the universe. I cannot think of any need in childhood as strong as the need for a father's protection, writes Freud. Thus, continues Freud, the part played by the oceanic feeling, which might seek something like the restoration of a limitless narcissism, is ousted from a place in the foreground. The origin of religious attitude can be traced back in clear outlines as far as the feeling of infantile helplessness. There may be something further behind that, but for the present, it is wrapped in obscurity. What mysterious object lays wrapped in obscurity, which is even deeper than the child's need for a parent, stands beyond us as well for the present moment. Freud will return to it in the final chapter of the book, in his discussion of the superego and the conflict between Eros and Thanatos, the libidinous desire for life and the destructive death drive, all from Freudian concepts for another time. Freud concludes his first chapter with the assumption that the oceanic feeling became connected with religion only later on. This is done by moving again from the contentless sensation to an ideational elaboration, a claim about the nature of reality extrapolated from our private subjective feelings. Freud writes, "The oneness with the universe, which constitutes the oceanic feeling's ideational content, sounds like a first attempt at a religious consolation, as though it were another way of disclaiming the danger which the ego recognizes as threatening it from the external world. Namely, that this elaborated belief in the oneness of the universe or the unity of existence is merely a defense mechanism against a harsher reality of a world separate from us, a way to cope with that which lies beyond the comfort of the mother's breast." But Freud isn't finished. He has one last thing to add. In the very last paragraph of this first chapter, Freud quotes another friend whose insatiable craving for knowledge has led him to make the most unusual experiments and has ended up giving him encyclopedic knowledge. This friend has assured me, writes Freud, that through the practices of yoga, by withdrawing from the world, by fixing the attention on bodily functions, and by peculiar methods of breathing, one can in fact invoke new sensations and co-anesthesias in oneself, which he regards as regressions to primordial states of mind which have long ago been overlaid. He sees in them, concludes Freud, a psychological basis, as it were, for much of the wisdom of mysticism. This final comment, which Freud conveys quite respectfully, throws open a whole new window and avenue of exploration into the domain of the mystical. Freud's response, however, to this unnamed friend is short and enigmatic. Freud writes, "It would not be hard to find connections here with a number of obscure modifications of mental life, such as trances and ecstasies, but I am moved to exclaim in the words of Schiller's Diver, let him rejoice who breathes up here in the rose-colored light." Namely, that while there may indeed be what to be found of psychological value in the deep oceanic dives into the mystical, I, says Freud, prefer to conduct my observations and research under the light of day here on firm, dry ground. Who is this mystical other friend with an encyclopedic knowledge of mysticism and keen psychological insight that Freud writes of? The French historian and psychoanalyst Henri Vermorel claims that this friend was Frederick Eckstein, an Austrian polymath and theosophist with interests in Pythagoras, Neoplatonism, German and Spanish mysticism, the legends of the Templars and the Freemasons, Wagnerian mythology and Eastern religions, and, notable for present purposes, also a friend of Sigmund Freud. William Parsons argues, however, that this other friend was actually none other than Romain Rolland, the same person Freud had been responding to all along. Why Freud chooses to obscure his identity with the introduction of a new imaginary friend is a good question, to which I don't have the answer. Freud's final diagnosis, to zoom out for just a second, is that the oceanic feeling of mysticism is best explained as a regression to the primitive ego of the infant, which does not recognize itself as separate from the rest of the world around it. This state of limitless narcissistic union between the infant and the mother, and that the true source of religion is not this oceanic feeling, but an infantile feeling of helplessness which can be traced to the child's need for their father's protection. This objection to a unitive interpretation of the oceanic feeling follows Freud's general philosophical, or rather anti-philosophical approach, as evident from a letter he wrote to Georg Grodeck, a German doctor and psychologist, a controversial but important figure within the psychoanalytic movement, to whom Freud credited the very term id. Freud at one point writes to Grodeck, who, by the way, was also deeply interested in Christian mysticism and the parallels it held to psychoanalysis. Freud writes to him like this: "I'm afraid that you are a philosopher as well and have the monistic tendency to disparage all the beautiful differences of nature in favor of tempting unity. But does this help eliminate the differences?" Freud, being the modern thinker he was, and in no small ways a sculptor of modern thought, preferred all of the beautiful differences over the indifferent unity which he saw in monistic mysticism and philosophy. Rolland, in his attempt to open Freud to the mystical, was really fighting an uphill battle. But despite this predisposition for diversity, Freud does, in his Civilization and Its Discontents, recognize the psychological need that humans have for cohesion and unity. And this perhaps may point us to that exact mysterious object wrapped in obscurity, which lays even further in the human psyche behind the child's need for their father. In the final chapter of Civilization and Its Discontents, Freud, to quote Downing again, explores mysticism's relation to orgasmic fulfillment, to the narcissistic temptation to withdraw libido from the outer world, and thus to recover that sense of being whole in ourselves and at one with the world that we fantasize we experience at the beginning. Freud makes clear that he recognizes this longing for oneness, for wholeness, harmony, and consolation, as representing one of the two deepest forces at work in the human soul, and perhaps ultimately the deeper one. Just to spell this all out a little. What Freud is doing here is drawing a connection between our longing for peace, harmony, resolution, and completion with what he calls the death drive. And although death drive sounds kind of scary, like it's straight out of some heavy metal band or a drag racing tournament, death drive, in Freud's account, is just one of the two primary forces at work in the human psyche, the other being eros, the drive to live, create, and procreate. These two drives, Freud sees as being in constant battle with one another, and indicates that perhaps the death drive is ultimately the deeper of the two, making Freud's association of mysticism, the desire for oneness, harmony, and wholeness, with the death drive all the more interesting. This association of mysticism with the death drive, however, also means that Freud sees this desire for wholeness that finds expression in mysticism as being tied up to the human drive for aggression and destruction, the desire to reduce everything to its lowest common denominator, a unified darkness, a black hole of emptiless peace and deathly silence, to death itself, not a chirpy vision. Freud concludes civilization and its discontents with these words. The fateful question for the human species seems to me to be whether and to what extent their cultural development will succeed in mastering the disturbance of their communal life by the human instinct of aggression and self-destruction. It may be that in this respect, precisely the present time deserves a special interest. Men have gained control over the forces of nature to such an extent that with their help, they would have no difficulty in exterminating one another to the last man. They know this, and hence comes a large part of the current unrest, their unhappiness and their mood of anxiety. And here Freud inserts a glimmer of hope. And now it is to be expected that the other of the two heavenly powers, eternal Eros, will make an effort to assert himself in the struggle with his equally immortal adversary. Freud adds one final ominous sentence in 1931, when Hitler's dark vision already began to spread over Europe. But, writes Freud, who can foresee with what success and with what result? Freud is hoping, almost praying here, for the return of eternal Eros, against the rising tide of totalitarianism, occultism, myth, mysticism, and uniformity, all which unfortunately found their fair share of personification in Hitler and his thugs. What Freud seems to be doing here is creating a cluster of ideas, grouping together religion, mysticism, occultism, illusion, totalitarianism, political, metaphysical, or otherwise, and attaching this cluster of ideas to his notion of the death drive, of aggression and destruction. Freud then contrasts this cluster with an opposing set of ideas, most notably those of science and sexuality, Apollo and Eros, which for him stood as accurate means of attaining and representing the real diversity and multiplicity of reality, and held these two, science and sexuality, as safeguards to keep us anchored and attached to reality against the black tide of occultism. I was originally going to make this all one long video, but things were getting a bit too long and there was too much I wanted to include. So what I've done is I've put a pause here on part one, and I hope you'll be patient enough with me to wait till next week for part two. And if you're watching this after a week, both will be available already for your viewing pleasure. I hope you enjoyed so far. Thank you once again for coming to join us to learn. Thank you to our patrons for supporting this work that we do here. And until next time, keep seeking.